WTC on the Voice of America.
Welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza, working on this program very remote. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan and South Sudan this Tuesday, September 13, 2022. South Sudan's first Vice President Riek Machar is calling on the international community to lift sanctions on companies investing in his country's oil industry.
Coming into markets like South Sudan and across the region, it's a big issue. And I hope that in the next 2 days we address those issues and find sustainable ways to get creative financing on how we move and we move this industry forward.
And Kenya has a new president.
So our teams are on the ground in case of anything, but the situation is calm.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. South Sudan's first Vice President Riek Machar is asking the international community to ease restrictions on the country's oil sector to boost production. South Sudan's Minister for Petroleum says sanctions imposed on local companies investing in South Sudan's oil industry has hindered foreign investment. Dengai Deng has more for VOA from Juba.
Speaking at the start of a two-day oil and power conference in Juba, First Vice President Riek Machar says the international community should support South Sudan by allowing investors fewer restrictions so the government can up its oil production to generate more economic development.
Since peace was signed, we now have some kilometers of asphalted road from the capital, both going north on the eastern side of the river, the Nile River, going to Bor. It will continue up to Rang and link up with Sudan. The other is in the west, going Rumbe, Wau, and will also link up with Sudan and would also link with Central Africa. We could not have done this without making use of the oil that God has given us. So in a short time now, we are building highways. And some of these gentlemen and ladies, if they decide to invest in the oil sector, and we increase our production to 2 million medically.
South Sudan Petroleum Minister Port Kang Chol says the U.S. imposed sanctions on individuals operating in South Sudan's oil sector hinder investment and prevent the country from harnessing its natural resources on behalf of its people.
The future of this country does not belong to those of us who are on this estate. The future of this country belongs to those children who are playing football on the streets. And their future cannot be punished because of our own mistakes. And I've been telling those who sanction us over and over again that when you continue to sanction us, and you are not only helping us on how to solve our internal crisis, you will not be helping the situation. You will be like somebody, because currently the world is taking care of our refugees. The world is taking care of our people who are in the IDP camps. If we are help on how to bring peace and permanent peace to the Republic of South Sudan, this government will be responsible for its own citizens.
In March 2018, the United States imposed sanctions on 15 South Sudanese oil operators, whom the U.S. called corrupt officials actors. The sanctions were aimed at increasing pressure on President Salva Kiir to end the country's conflict and humanitarian crisis. The U.S. Department of State said the companies and governmental bodies would need to obtain special licenses to do business in the United States in the future. The State Department said the South Sudanese government and its corrupt actors use oil-related revenue to, quote, purchase weapons and fund irregular militias that undermine the peace, security, and stability of South Sudan, end quote. The list includes Dar Petroleum Operating Company, an oil and gas consortium led by China, and the National Petroleum Corporation, and Malaysia's state-run oil and gas firm Petronas, the two largest oil firms operating in South Sudan. The restrictions also cover oil distributor Nyakek and Sons, Greater Pioneer Operating, Juba Petrotech Technical Services, Nigeria's Oranto Petroleum, and Sud Petroleum Operating. A U.S. Department of Commerce document published shortly after the State Department announced the sanctions said the groups on the list were involved in activities that are contrary to the foreign policy interests of the United States. Speaking at the same conference, N.J. Ayuk, executive chairman of the African Energy Chamber, also urged the United States to lift its sanctions.
Coming into markets like South Sudan and across the region, it's a big issue. And I hope that in the next 2 days we address those issues and find sustainable ways to get creative financing on how we move and we move this industry forward. But we can't move this industry without tackling on some of the sensitive issues. Issues around governance that we all are dealing with. But also issues around sanctions. I might get in trouble for saying this, but I think it's time to end the sanctions in South Sudan. The industry. It's crippling the economy.
Aside from local officials, regional energy ministers and global oil executives from Europe and the Arab world are also attending the Juba conference, where officials and executives are expected to network and dialogue. The South Sudan Oil and Power 2020 conference consolidates the country's position as a hub for petroleum industry services and exploration in the country and across the region. Its strategic location makes South Sudan an ideal partner for emerging producers in Uganda, Kenya, Somalia, and Tanzania. For VOA News, I am Dengai Deng in Juba.
Some lawmakers representing Upper Nile State in the National Legislative Assembly are calling on the national government to provide security and protect civilians in Panyikang County. The lawmakers say they are shocked and saddened by attacks on innocent civilians during clashes between SPLM-IO Kidgwang factions. For VOA News, Viola Elias reports from Juba.
Addressing reporters in Juba yesterday, some members of the parliament who represent the Cholo or Shulu community condemned what they called the heinous killing of civilians in Upper Nile State, Panyikang County. Reading a prepared statement on behalf of her fellow lawmakers, MP Rebecca Joshua Okwachi said at least 8,000 people have been displaced by the conflict in the area. Okwachi says MPs were shocked by the attacks on unarmed civilians.
We, the Cholo MPs, in the Transitional National Legislature, condemn in the strongest terms the incident which took place in Adudiang in Panyikang County, Upper Nile State, at 2 p.m. on 8th September 2022. The population, which was displaced from Tonga as a result of previous conflict, the majority of whom were women, children, and the elderly, settled in Adudiang village to receive relief. After the attack on Adudiang area, those who were counted who have survived the attack were reportedly over 7,500.
Kwachi says the MPs are urging the government to intervene and provide security to unarmed civilians in Panyikang County to prevent more bloodshed.
We also call on our government to take quick and serious measures to apprehend the criminals and bring them to book so that such incidents do not repeat themselves, and also encourage the parties and communities to work for peace and stability in our country. We appeal to the Ministry of Humanitarian Affairs to provide humanitarian support to the displaced.
Okwachi says the MPs are aware of the presence of armed groups such as Kidgwang faction, the White Army, and other forces in the area who allegedly carried out attacks on innocent civilians in the state. The MPs say it is unfortunate that despite the signed 2018 peace agreement, some forces still commit criminal attacks on civilians. National lawmaker Yor Ukuch, who also hails from Upper Nile State, says South Sudan is implementing the peace deal and armed groups should be part of it. Ukuch urges the government to resolve disagreement among different militias factions in the state to prevent more killing.
We ask the government to call his part who are under his responsibility and then to resolve the case of killing innocent people. We supposed to protect our citizens, but now we find them they are being killed without clear reason. Another thing, we call the international community and NGOs to support them because their situation there is very terrible.
South Sudan People Defense Force spokesperson Major General Lul Roy Kong says the conflict in Panyikang County is between the two rival factions of the SPLM-IO. Kong says it should be the responsibility of non-state actors who control the area to protect civilians.
The civilians that may be are caught up in the latest crisis areas under the control of those tribal factions. They are not fighting in areas under our control. And it is primary responsibility of every non-state actor to protect civilians in areas under control.
Last week, fighting in Adidiang village of Panyikang County reportedly broke out between rival forces of General Simon Gatwich and General Johnson Ulonch, the two senior commanders of the breakaway SPLM-IO faction. Last month, the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs said thousands of people displaced across Upper Nile and Unity states following heavy fighting between armed faction in Tunga Town and Panyikang County. For VOA News, I am Viola Elias in Juba.
From Juba, we move to Sudan, where Save the Children and the European Union has pledged to fund a project to save lives and build resilience in five Sudanese states. EU officials in Khartoum say the funds will be used to help alleviate challenges facing thousands of internally displaced persons, refugees, and host communities. For VOA News, Michael Atit has more from Khartoum.
European Union and Save the Children officials say 6.7 million euro project will directly benefit more than 370,000 people, including over 190,000 children under the age of five in Khartoum, Blue Nile, Central Darfur, South Kordofan, and West Darfur states. The project targets most vulnerable, including displaced persons affected by conflict, especially children who are at most risk of malnutrition and diseases. During the project period, Save the Children will provide access to life-saving and life-sustaining healthcare and nutrition services across 24 health facilities, as well as disaster preparedness activities. It will also include training for community volunteers who will identify potential hazards and possible solutions. Speaking during a launch of the program in Khartoum over the weekend, Wim Fransen, head of the EU's humanitarian aid operations in Khartoum, said the project will support families in hard-to-reach communities of some of the most conflicted affected states.
This program is indeed to try to improve the access for crisis-affected vulnerable children and their families, including people with disabilities, to improve their access to life-saving health, nutrition, and protection services, as well as provide some basic needs assistance, livelihoods, and disaster preparedness through integrated services.
By supporting Save the Children and other humanitarian groups, Fransen says the EU is helping alleviate the challenges faced by thousands of displaced refugees and host communities in Sudan. Speaking at the same event, Save the Children's country director, Arshad Malik, said his agency is working to fulfill its promise to transform the lives of children, especially the most vulnerable and marginalized in Sudan, who have been affected by communal conflict, the worsening economic crisis, and disasters exacerbated by climate change.
Save the Children teams are at the moment on ground in River Nile, where we are doing mobile clinics in the state in a few localities. We are also at the moment supporting another locality in Jazira State, where our teams are also working with a local partner, Sadakat, to deliver health, nutrition, and wash services as well as child protection.
Malik says Save the Children is also assessing the impacts of flooding in Khartoum. Speaking by phone from Jebel Moon locality in West Darfur State, Muhammad Ibrahim, director of the Social Development Department, says he expects hundreds of local communities displaced by conflict to benefit from the project. Ibrahim says communities in Jebel Moon and surrounding villages have suffered from lack of basic services due to repeated intercommunal attacks, which forced many aid agencies to suspend operations.
They left most of these areas, such as Hemema and other important areas along the border with Chad. There's a need for resuming operations there. In Salea, a renovation was made to the health facility there and one medical doctor was provided, in addition to a social insurance center. The only lack of services is within the displacement camps.
Jebel Moon had witnessed on and off intercommunal clashes since last year, killing dozens of people, injuring scores of others, and displacing thousands of families. In June, the United Nations World Food Programme in Sudan warned against looming hunger in the country, with nearly 15 million people, or about a third of the nation's population, facing acute food insecurity. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Coming up, Kenya has a new president. Stay tuned for that story after the break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
is there such a thing as unconditional love?
The reason why I say it's there, because I've seen my parents and I've seen there is unconditional love in their relationship. Basing on the way like my dad treats my mom, the love is unconditional.
No, I don't think that. It is very difficult to predict human beings. So human beings are just unpredictable. Anybody can change at any time. So that's why I believe there is no unconditional love.
I'm one of the people who believe in real love, and therefore I believe in unconditional love. It exists. It's there. It's been exercised among people. And we have the ability to give unconditional love. So it's there.
Honestly, I've not been there before, so I don't know much about it, but a lot of things that I've seen people are struggling to love each other.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
President Salva Kiir attended the swearing-in ceremony for William Ruto, Kenya's fifth president, after a tightly contested election and a narrow win against his rival Raila Odinga, who declined to attend the ceremony. At least 40 people were injured as Kenyans scrambled to enter the stadium to watch the event. Muhammad Yusuf reports for VOA from Nairobi.
Tens of thousands of Kenyans and at least 20 heads of state gathered at Moi International Sports Center in Nairobi to witness the swearing-in of the Kenya's fifth president, William Ruto. Many people tried to force their way into the stadium, and Kenya's Red Cross Communications Manager, Peter Abuawa, says first responders treated about 40 people with minor injuries.
There were those who tried to jump over the fence, and then some fell, some sustained cuts. So there weren't any major injuries as such, and they've been given a first aid. So our teams are on the ground in case of anything, but the situation is calm.
William Ruto takes the reins of power from outgoing President Uhuru Kenyatta, his former boss. As deputy president, Ruto fell out with Kenyatta, who supported his rival in last month's election, Raila Odinga. Odinga lost with 6.9 million votes to Ruto's 7.1 million in an election marked by low voter turnout, a split election commission, and allegations of fraud by Odinga. Despite supporting Odinga, Kenyatta welcomed the incoming president with a tour of State House, the Kenyan president's official residence. He urged Ruto to work for all Kenyans without favoritism. Odinga, who challenged his loss unsuccessfully at Kenya's Supreme Court, did not attend Tuesday's swearing-in ceremony. President Ruto faces the daunting task of lowering a high cost of living and managing a massive debt after years of borrowing. The 55-year-old Ruto vowed to work for all Kenyans, reduce external borrowing, and deal with corruption. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
From Kenya, we move to the Horn of Africa, where Ethiopia's Tigrayan forces called for an immediate ceasefire Sunday and said they will join an African Union-led peace process after 3 weeks of renewed fighting ended a fragile truce. Heather reports.
Tigrayan forces from Ethiopia's northern region have said they are prepared to participate in an immediate cessation of hostilities, followed by peace talks mediated by the African Union. In a statement to mark the beginning of the Ethiopian New Year, the Tigray region's leadership called for a comprehensive negotiated ceasefire and said they had established a negotiating team that is ready to be deployed without delay. The government of Tigray is prepared to participate in a robust peace process under the auspices of the African Union, the statement said. The statement came as heavy fighting was reported along Tigray's northern, eastern, and southern borders. The latest round of hostilities erupted on the 24th of August, bringing an end to a ceasefire agreed by the parties in late March. Each side blamed the other for starting the fighting. Thousands have been killed and millions displaced since the conflict broke out in November 2020. The Tigray forces have previously rejected the African Union as a mediator, claiming its peace envoy, former Nigeria President Olusegun Obasanjo, is too sympathetic to Ethiopia's federal government and expressing a preference for talks in Nairobi overseen by Kenya and the US. Their call for a ceasefire was welcomed by the AU, the European Union and the United Nations. On Thursday, the UN said the fighting has halted much-needed aid deliveries to Tigray and war-affected parts of the neighboring region of Amhara. The AU chairperson described the ceasefire call as a unique opportunity towards the restoration of peace in the Federal Democratic Republic of Ethiopia, while the EU Foreign Affairs head, Josep Borrell, said the EU was ready to support talks. Ethiopia's federal government has not yet responded to the statements from the Tigray region's leadership, but it has previously said it is ready to participate in AU-led talks anytime, anywhere, while also questioning the Tigray forces' commitment to resolving the conflict through dialogue. Fred Harter for VOA News, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
A new report presented at the opening of the 51st session of the UN Human Rights Council paints an alarming picture of growing abuse and violence in all regions of the world, with few rays of hope for a peaceful resolution. For VOA News, Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Acting High Commissioner for Human Rights, Nada Al-Nashif, highlighted the growing desperation of millions of people trapped in a never-ending cycle of human rights violations, violence, and political instability in dozens of countries around the world. She addressed the worsening situation in numerous countries in Africa, including Burkina Faso, Burundi, the Central African Republic, and Mali. She offered a rare glimmer of hope regarding the nearly two-year-old conflict in northern Ethiopia's Tigray province.
Following the recent resumption of hostilities in northern Ethiopia, I am encouraged by the announcement yesterday by authorities in Tigray of their readiness to abide by an immediate cessation of hostilities and to participate in a robust peace process under the auspices of the African Union. I urge the parties to take immediate steps to end the violence once and for all and to opt for constructive and genuine dialogue.
She dwelled at length on the unbearable levels of violence and human rights abuses by heavily armed gangs in Haiti. She called on the international community to help contain the scourge of violence in that country. However, she made only passing reference to China's incarceration of more than a million Uyghur and other Muslim minorities in so-called vocational centers. This is despite growing demands by human rights activists for a special debate on this issue at the Council.
On 31 August, my office published its assessment of human rights concerns in the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region of China with recommendations to the government and other stakeholders.
Acting High Commissioner Al-Nashif was more robust in her criticism of Russia's actions aimed at quelling domestic opposition to its war in Ukraine.
In the Russian Federation, the intimidation, restrictive measures, and sanctions against people voicing opposition to the war in Ukraine undermine the exercise of constitutionally guaranteed fundamental freedoms. Pressure against journalists, blocking of internet resources and other forms of censorship are incompatible with media pluralism and violate the right to access of information.
Al-Nashif said the war in Ukraine continues and the suffering of the civilian population continues. She noted the serious socioeconomic consequences of the war also persist. This, she said, has resulted in severe fuel shortages and threats to food security in some of the world's poorest countries. She added, the devastation caused by the war in Ukraine will be discussed later in the session. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
The World Health Organization and U.S. Centers for Disease Control say coughing and sneezing can spread COVID-19. Physical distancing, staying at least 1 meter away from people outside your family, can protect everyone. For more information, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa CDC. And remember to listen to VOA for the latest on COVID-19.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
And that wraps up our show for this Monday. Don't forget to check out voanews.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. And for old news, go to voanews.com. If you missed this broadcast, go to voanews.com/South Sudan. We now leave you with Victoria Ole and the song, Oh Mama. Listening to Victoria Ole and the song Oh Mama. I'm your host, John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for allowing us into your homes, phones, and vehicles. Join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Roho bita mama, itashini kuluhaja besi, uodifigida muta.